Dylan Brody is a comic, a storyteller, a writer, and a screenwriter in Los Angeles, California. I spoke with him about his new CD, Writ Large, that's W-R-I-T, large, which comes out on iTunes and all the usual online places on April 2nd. May 2nd, his latest book, Last Laugh, comes out. It's about the life of a stand-up comic. So look for that. And he begins shooting his screenplay, The Dylan Brody Project, this year, so we'll keep an eye on that too. Here's some of our conversation from this afternoon. We're speaking with Dylan Brody, purveyor of fine words and phrases from Los Angeles. And Dylan, you want to tell us a little bit about your journey from stand-up comic, slinging dick jokes for the drunks, to purveyor of fine words and phrases, or raconteur, or storyteller, or I'm not sure what to call what you do.
Everything you just said is what we call what I do.
Great.
And the truth is, if it were 1958, I would be a comic. What I do isn't that different from what Bill Cosby was doing, or Bob Newhart in some ways. There used to be a place for long-form humor in the humor scape. But since the 80s and 90s, stand-up comedy is expected to be a laugh every 15 seconds, and I don't guarantee that with what I do. I don't just do quick punchlines. I weave longer tales. I was a heavy-duty road comic doing political stand-up through my youth. I started when I was 17, and I did it until I was about 32, 33. And I started to hate myself. I was starting to hate my audience. I wasn't really having any fun. At just the point where I got my first TV exposure, which was that same year, in 94, I did A&E's Comedy on the Road, hosted by John Biner, and that was supposed to push me to headliner everywhere. And instead, it turned out that was the end of the comedy boom, and hundreds of clubs across the country closed.
I remember that, yeah.
So what happened was I'd finally gotten the break I had been looking for, and it didn't change my career at all. I was still going to be featuring most places. Where I was headlining, I was going to be making what I used to make as a feature. And it was just so disappointing that I spiraled into a depression. And I, you know, when I get depressed, I don't kid around. My mood can spiral downward like Larry Flint at the Guggenheim. I would wake up every morning and just look in the mirror and think, oh, great, this guy again. And it was horrible. And so I wasn't feeling funny. I wasn't interested in being funny. And I stumbled into martial arts. Therapy and martial arts helped me to start to fight the depression. But that also caused me to quit smoking pot. And I didn't know who I was. Pot smoking had been so much a part of my persona and my self-image that I couldn't go out and perform if I wasn't a stoner. I didn't know how to present in the world. So I, you know, huddled at my desk and I wrote anything that would pay me. I wrote a lot of trailers for movies. I wrote my first book got published. I did a lot of writing. And then in the early 2000s at some point, I had an opportunity to record a piece. I recorded this one story, and I submitted it to a radio station, and they liked it and asked me to start doing more. So I was sitting at home writing and recording stories for them. And then I started to get the Jones for performance again. I thought, maybe these will work. Maybe I can take the stories out and use that as a performance structure. And I stumbled into it that way, one step at a time, not certain at any moment that anything was going to work out well at all. And very quickly I found that I have an audience, that there are people who crave long-form storytelling, that there is a huge part of the population that is not ashamed to be smarter than a fifth grader.
Right.
And is interested in hearing complex stories.
Well, just so the audience and the listeners know, what you do is still comedy. So, yeah, don't be put
off.
I like
to believe it is.
Yes, absolutely. I was playing one of your long stories. I think it was the It was the one on a ship or something, you know? I forget.
Oh,
it
had Know Your Audience. That's called Know Your Audience.
Yeah,
I think it's chronological.
That's a great one. The heavy metal guy was driving in to after my show, and when you get within a mile of the station, you lose the signal. And he goes, "Oh man, I was listening for the whole 10 minutes, and I missed the end." He was like really upset.
Oh, God, very sad. Yeah. Interestingly, I work at a radio station intermittently out here in Los Angeles, National Public Radio. I do commentary for KPCC, and for some reason, the only time I lose the station is when I'm driving to work there.
Right. Yeah. Right. I don't know why. So tell us a little bit about your new release, and you're very prolific. You release an album about once a year, right?
I try to do one every year. Yeah, I force myself to do one a year if I possibly can, because that keeps me writing new material and keeps me plumbing the depths of my soul for more darkness at which people may point and laugh.
And you managed to get out enough to work with an audience and hone a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I work around town a lot and then intermittently on the road. So I get plenty of time to be with audiences. And by the time I'm recording, I know exactly what I'm doing with all the stories. Except on the new CD, there's some improvisational stuff that's structured improv that, of course, is not scripted. So the new CD is called Writ Large, and it drops out April 2nd, and I am incredibly proud of this CD.
Great.
There is some genuinely funny laugh-aloud stuff on it, and then there is other stuff that was so scary for me to tell. Because coming from a world of comedy, you get used to that constant feedback from the audience. And as a storyteller, there are times when it is just the sound of the listening. And it's silence in the room, and that's valid. As long as it doesn't turn into coughs and shuffles, you're good. And it takes a long time to really understand that that's them being there and being with you and listening. And there are some moments on this CD that, at least to me, seem really kind of intense and personal. And I'm thrilled with the stuff I put on this CD. I cannot wait to find out how it is received by my audience. The previous one, Chronological Disorder, I leaned way farther into sort of loosely format comedy and jokes than I had on any of the previous ones. And on this one, I allowed myself to trust the audience a little more and lean further into the personal and the revelatory, and it is such fun.
I know what you're talking about because I know I have friends that are in the stand-up world, and there's such a difference between, you know, honing a joke, you know, in front of an audience and getting the beats and the timing and for the laugh, and then doing something for the radio where you write it, you perform it, and it's done. You
know? Yeah.
It's quite a difference.
It's a very different feel.
I don't know which is harder, though. I've tried stand-up a little bit, and I did okay, but I dropped some real heavy bombs. So I said, I'm too old to learn a new craft.
Well, that happens.
Yeah.
You know, as you learn it, there's a lot of tripping and falling. Once you've done stand-up long enough, at least for me, I don't know that this is true for everyone, but at a certain point with stand-up, and I was also, you know, writing jokes for other comics and so on, I became able to write a joke and know whether or not it would work. Early on, there's a lot of, let me see if this is going to work. Okay, that doesn't work. I'll cut it. But by the time I was really working heavily on the road, I could write a joke in the hotel room and know it was going to work, or write a joke and know it wasn't going to work, and I wouldn't use it until I figured out what was wrong with it. And there's a lot of that in what I do as a storyteller. I know where the laughs are in the stories, whether I'm recording them in a studio for airplay or taking them out to clubs to work them live. Once a certain level of confidence has been achieved as a performer, you don't really need to worry that much about bombing. Occasionally it'll happen. You'll get an audience that's too drunk to follow a thought, or you'll just be in the wrong space for your material or what have you, and it'll happen. but it's no longer a concern because it's no longer about whether or not you're doing it right.
Right. So in your creative process, do you start with the in the writing frame, or do you just kind of turn all the noise off and then start talking to yourself in your head?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think those are the same thing. I think the writing frame is all about talking to yourself in your head.
Uh-huh.
Some of my pieces, particularly the more poetic pieces, I write while I'm driving. The longer the piece is, the more likely it is that I sat down at the computer and started with a thought and found out where it took me. There's a piece on Twist of the Wit, the title piece, actually, on A Twist of the Wit, which it's not the title of the piece, but it's the piece that has that phrase in it. I wrote entirely on a drive to a club, including the intro to it.
Nice.
If I may, anyone who's familiar with my work, and really who isn't, will be aware that a lot of my stories can be long and heavy, like the multi-textured shades of gray, like the prominent proboscis of the ponderous pachyderm. This piece, to maintain the mammalian metaphor, is little more than a bit or two of gerbil fuzz, a beat or two of verbal jazz. It's a twist of the wit, a trick of the tongue. It's a tantalizing taste of linguistic terpsichore, a pithy parcel of prosodic prestidigitation, if you will.
Wow.
And if you won't, a bunch of anti-Semitic bastards. This is called I Like to Support the Arts. On the way home from a gig, I stopped at a convenience store to buy milk for my morning coffee, ice cream for my wife. I was approached in the parking lot by an unemployed magician. He had the hungry eyes of a haunted hound. He said, I got a quarter in my pocket, I can make it disappear. I said, show me. I swear to you, all he did was snap his fingers. He said, it's gone. I said, where did it go? He said, check your pocket. I checked my pocket, and sure enough, there, amongst all my other loose change, a bright, shiny quarter. I said, how do I know this is yours? He said, check the date. I looked at the date. I said, it's from 1994. He said, that's mine. I said, that's amazing. I returned it to him. I
Great.
Said, do it again. He said, I never repeat myself. I said, show me another. He said, I'll need a $10 bill. I said, all I have is a 20. He said, that will do. I handed him a $20 bill. He folded it up right in front of me. No alakadabra, no abracadabra. When he unfolded it, it was a 5. He returned it to me. I said, that's amazing. Change it back. He said, if I could change 5s into 20s, I wouldn't be out here working for tips. I said, I'm sorry. I didn't know I was supposed to tip you. I like to support the arts. I gave him the 5. I went into the store. I bought milk for my morning coffee. I bought ice cream for my wife. As I emerged, he was approaching another man in the parking lot. He said, I got a quarter in my pocket. I can make it disappear. I got a quarter in my pocket. I can make it disappear. I watched him with the hungry eyes of a hunting hawk, and I swear to you, all he did was snap his fingers.
Well done.
On that trip, I haven't told this story in a long time, but on that trip, I had to buy condoms in Georgia because my wife had forgotten to bring birth control, which, well, now that I think about it, that may just have been a passive-aggressive form of prophylactic contraception in itself. But I had to go buy condoms, and it had been a long time since I've had to buy. We used to use the sponges, but they don't make those anymore. Well, they make them, but they have the Brillo on one side, and I didn't want to use that. So I had to go in and buy condoms for the first time and I said, I'd like to buy some condoms. And the guy said, don't worry, everybody does this now. It's okay. What size would you like? And that's new. That's since the last time. He could see that I was stunned because I didn't want to say, what have you gotten a petite? And he said, don't worry. And he handed me a board with these different sized holes in it. Like I had to gauge spaghetti for a party. He said, go in the back room, find out what size you are. Came back 20 minutes later. I said, forget the condoms. How much you want for this board?
That cut was from Dylan Brody's new CD coming out April 2nd. Before that, part of a conversation we had this afternoon. We'll hear more of that next week. Coming up next, a cut from Dylan's CD, which came out last year, Chronological Disorder. Available online. Check it out.
This is a funny story, I hope. I studied in London. I studied acting at the very pompous Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, RADA. And
I studied voice and speech and breath control and stage movement and scene work and textual deconstruction and playwriting and theater history and Shakespeare and contemporary acting styles and Alexander technique and stage combat and tumbling. And while I was there, a friend of mine called me who was studying at the marginally less pompous Lambda, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, because he was going to be in a Tennessee Williams play and he wanted me to come see it. And to my mind, nothing promises an evening of great theater like British college students doing American Southern accents. So I put on my very best go-to-theater shirt and I took the tube over to Lambda. And the show didn't suck. There was this one woman in it who was wonderful. Her Southern accent was strong, and she was fully committed, and she was lovely and funny at the right moments. And so when my friend said, "Would you like to come out for a pint with us after?" I said, "Sure," partly because I wanted to hit on this woman, and partly because at that time I was networking every chance I got because I had ambitions of Shakespearean proportions. So I went out to the pub with them, and I was sitting with this woman, and I had drunk a pint and a half of lukewarm, overly strong ale, and we'd been talking for maybe 2 hours, and I was charming and young and thin, and I had my exotic American accent going for me. And then I realized I had never learned her name. There's a certain point in a conversation when it has been too long, and you can no longer say, "I'm sorry, I am too self-involved to be allowed out in public." So I tried to cover by saying, "What is your full name?" As though I was about to perform some numerological bar trick in which I added up the letters and told her fortune. In fact, as I said it, I was devising a numerological bar trick in which I would add up the letters. And she said, "Oh, it's Julie Kate Olivier." And I said, "Oh, really, any relation to Sir Lawrence?" And I tried to sound smarmy and sarcastic enough so that she would know that I knew that she had heard this joke every day since she first went into acting. But she was perfectly comfortable with who she was. So she said, "Yes, he's my father." Instantly, she went from being a hot prospect to being a golden ticket. For 2 hours, I had been thinking of ways to take advantage of her, and now all I could think of was ways to take advantage of her. And I knew if I waited another half a second, she was going to see the venal desire and greed and ambition in my hungry, boorish American acting student eyes. So I raised the beer in front of my mouth to cover, and I steered my focus back to the drape of her hair, where it fell past the curve of her neck, and that little place on her clavicle where I was pretty sure if I touched it with my lips and breathed out through my nose, I could make her shiver. And I imagined waking up next to her in those overly starched, low thread count, stiff, grimy British sheets. I imagined having breakfast with her in a nook, pouring tea and having scones as the cool British sunlight slanted down through a window across the formica between us. And then, unbidden into my fantasy, her father came down the stairs. Probably from a tryst with Danny Kaye. He was wearing a burgundy bathrobe and matching velour slippers, and I could see the pale blue veins through the translucent flesh of his spindly old English actor legs. And the image was so full and rich and huge in my mind that it pushed the beer out through my nose. And I protected my best go-to-theater shirt by catching the beer in the glass before it could hit me. And I looked to Julie Kate Olivier, expecting her to say, "Oh, jolly good," or "cricket," or whatever the hell British people say when they have witnessed ninja-like reflexes in action. What I saw was such horror. As from her perspective, a boorish young American acting student had heard of her noble theatrical lineage, tried to impress her with a bar trick in which he recycled beer through his own sinus cavity into his glass. And I knew there would be no backdoor audition for the Royal Shakespeare Company, no handshake introduction to the National Theater. And I heard a voice in the back of my head that spoke with elegant elocution and exquisite breath control. And it said, "Not to be."
I'm Tony Hendrow.
And I'm Jeff Kreisler.
And this is the Final Edition Radio Hour.
This portion of the Final Edition Radio Hour is brought to you by the Oil is Green Foundation.
Why do we hate oil so? Why do we blame oil for global warming, the pollution of our air and seas, the death of millions of species? Oil is not our enemy. Oil is a child of Mother Earth. Oil is numberless trillions of trees, shrubs, plants, flowers, fruits, grains, and as many species of birds, reptiles, mammals, living organisms, large and small, all totally organic, every single cell of which passed away of natural causes. Gently compressed by organic, natural processes, oil ages deep in the bosom of Mother Earth for millions and millions of years. Like the finest wine in a vast underground cellar, it matures into thick, luscious, darkly shining, nutrient-rich, intensely concentrated earth juice. Oil is the blood that flows through our planet's hearts and veins. Oil is the essence of life. So let's stop wasting our time and money on unreliable, renewable energy. Stop destroying America's purpled majesty with ugly wind and solar farms. Stop turning her amber waves of grain into useless ethanol instead of feeding a hungry planet. And thank Mother Earth for oil, the greenest of all her children.
This has been a message from Coke Industries Oil and Gas Division.
Things go better with Coke.
You're listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour. In media news, Fox News and MSNBC have officially swapped their politics. Our Stone Peck has the story.
Fox News says it's just going to side with the Democratic Party, while MSNBC says they seem to be the Republican network.
What do we cover at Fox? President Obama, Benghazi, Dianne Feinstein, Senator Robert Menendez. We just talk about Democrats. The only conservatives are our staff.
Over at MSNBC, a similar story.
We'd spend hours talking about Sarah Palin and Donald Trump. We're the only ones covering George W. Bush anymore. We had wall-to-wall coverage of the Conservative Political Action Conference. Nobody covered CPAC the way we did. We owned that story.
So you made a deal with Fox?
Yeah, we're just going to trade staffs. We get Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, Ann Coulter, all those people. Fox gets Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, Chris Matthews, and Keith Olbermann.
Keith Olbermann doesn't even work for MSNBC anymore.
Yeah, well, they're getting him anyway.
In other news, ABC and CBS also swapped programming. No one noticed. BBC and PBS followed suit. So did C-SPAN 1 and C-SPAN 3. Current and Al Jazeera.
Welcome, Santa Cruz chapter of Friends of the Humpback Whale, to another of our whale spotting voyages off the beautiful Central California coast.
Hi.
Good to see you. Of course, we all know and love the legendary Songs of the Humpback Whale.
Yeah,
but you know, what are far less known and in their way just as beautiful are the farts of the humpback whale.
Really?
Oh, wow.
There's one of the lovely creatures now. Perhaps we'll get lucky. Unlike the humpback's songs, which can only be heard underwater, its farts are quite audible at sea level. You see, they come up to the surface to fart.
Well, I suppose that's some rudimentary form of courtesy to other whales.
That's a pretty thought. Oh, there she blows!
Is that a spout?
Like a spout. It's hot air becoming vapor ahead of the actual fart. With luck, we're about to hear one.
Will we be able to smell it too?
The farts of the humpback whale do not smell. Oh, hark!
That is so haunting.
I know. The richness, the profound power. It's like a mighty organ of the sea.
Well, it comes from an organ.
To me, it speaks volumes.
It's sure releasing volumes.
Greg, stop being a smartass. You're spoiling it for people.
There's another spout.
I always thought the spout came from its blowhole.
It's just a different blowhole.
The sheer majesty of it is mind-blowing.
What happens if you light one of their farts?
Actually, humpback whale farts are so powerful, you can light them underwater.
Wow. Has anyone ever done that?
Yeah. There's a group of scuba divers in Malibu dedicated to lighting humpback whale farts underwater. They call themselves the California Fast-Moving Fart Patrol. Oh, look. A whole pod of whales approaching our boat.
Oh, they're coming quite close. How beautiful they are.
Do humpback whales communicate by farting?
Yes, one will fart and another will fart back. Listen.
Why are they surrounding us with their tails towards us?
By turning their backs, they're showing their trust in us fellow mammals. It's a gesture of peace and friendship.
Oh, man, do you smell that? That is friggin' toxic. Something died inside that whale.
Hey, I told you, humpback whale farts are odorless.
Yeah? Well, don't light a match.
I hate to say this, but I think they're farting at us.
It's a whale fraternity, a gesture of fraternal flatulence.
Really? I thought these majestic animals were above this kind of sophomoric humor.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Krill farts are the worst.
That was from this week's Final Edition Radio Hour, produced by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler, engineered by Greg Russ. To hear the program in its entirety, check them out at thefinaledition.com. Dylan Brody is online at dylanbrody.com. This program is archived online. Simply Google The Inner Side. And check out our new Skeptics and Atheists podcast at skeptiles.com. This week we had a long talk with Jamila Bey, a journalist and radio producer from D.C., where she covers a lot of atheist issues and separation of church and state. This has been the Inner Side Radio Program. My name is Scooter, and I'll see y'all next week.
Down with disease, 3 weeks in my bed, trying to stop these demons that keep dancing in my head.